How did you know this? She said to Savannah.
My mother told me, said Savannah. Dad couldn't send any child support money for about 6 months. He said it cost a lot to relocate to Melbourne. And my mother said, why are you doing that? And he said, Joy Delaney said it was the right thing to do. I remember it, word for word. Mum had to get a second job to help pay for my ballet lessons.
Joy Delaney said it was the right thing to do, repeated Amy.
Wow, Mum. She shook her head.
Wow.
After all these years, it was not Stan, but their daughter looking at her with accusing eyes. She wanted to shout, but I did it for you. She tried to speak reasonably, but she couldn't keep the emotion out of her voice. I was not going to let you watch your father take some other kid to the top.
Better some other kid than no one at all, said Logan.
Harry would have won more Grand Slam titles by now if he'd stayed with Dad. He's never won a French Open title.
Harry never had the patience for clay, said Joy querulously.
Dad would have given him the patience. He's never been as consistent as he should have been, said Logan. He needed Dad.
You needed him, said Joy. You all needed him.
No, said Logan. I didn't.
God Almighty, she couldn't make him see. He was looking at this from the perspective of the 37-year-old man who had left his tennis career behind, not the 17-year-old boy who still saw tennis in his future.
Fine then. I needed him, said Joy. I had 4 children, all playing competitive tennis and a business to run. I couldn't do it on my own.
You must remember what it was like.
But she could see by their faces that they were blissfully oblivious to what it had been like. She thought of a night when Troy had been playing all the way out at Homebush in a tournament that ran so far behind schedule he didn't even get onto the court until midnight. Stan was with Troy, Joy was at home with the other kids. Logan was worryingly sick with a temperature. She didn't sleep that night. She baked 30 cupcakes for Brooke's birthday the next day in between tending to Logan. She did 3 loads of laundry. She did the accounts and she did Troy's history assignment on the Great Wall of China. She got 7 out of 10 for the assignment. She was still furious about that. She deserved a 9. When she thought of that long night, it was like remembering an extraordinarily tough match where she'd prevailed. Except there was no trophy or applause. The only recognition you got for surviving a night like that came from other mothers. Only they understood the epic nature of your trivial achievements. What had been the point of it all? And yet, how could she have done any of it differently? When it came to tennis at the level her children played, you were either in or you were out. And they wanted in. It would have been easier if they'd all been a little less talented, a little less driven, if they'd reached number 1 in the local district but gone no further. Anyway, might I remind you that you all hated Harry Haddad, said Joy, with a passion. She glanced at Savannah, who had closed the lid of the wooden chest that contained all her secrets and was now sitting on top of it, as if she were waiting for a bus. Sorry, Savannah, but they did hate your brother.
Oh, that's okay. I hated him too, said Savannah. For years, whenever his face came on the television, I screamed.
You literally screamed? Said Amy with interest.
I literally screamed, said Savannah.
I didn't hate Harry, said Logan. I envied him, but I never hated him.
I would have liked to have seen Dad keep coaching him.
That's what you think now, Logan, said Joy impatiently. But when you were a teenager, you thought very differently.
I hated him, said Troy. He leaned against the wall, his head perilously close to the sharp corner of the framed print of a crying mermaid that had always hung in Amy's room, which Joy found depressing, but Amy loved. Troy blazed rage and venom straight at Savannah.
I think you did the right thing, Mum, because obviously these charming people have no problem cheating, lying, scamming.
Okay, that's enough now, said Joy.
What? We need to show good manners to her?
Troy had such passionate yet fluid convictions about justice and morality. His teenage drug dealing empire was perfectly acceptable, but Savannah's scamming him for money was not. Cheating at tennis was an unforgivable sin, but then he'd gone right ahead and cheated on his lovely wife.
Look, if you're going to get all worked up about it, I'll transfer the money back to you, said Savannah to Troy. I just needed some cash to re-establish myself.
She sounded as if she were talking to a sibling about a loan she hadn't repaid. Was this her way of admitting that she'd lied to Troy when she made those dreadful accusations about Stan? What if Troy had actually refused to pay up? What would she have done next? Had Savannah understood the power of Joy's secret she'd just shared? Would Joy have paid up if she'd attempted to blackmail her? Possibly. Joy's head spun. She couldn't align Savannah, the sly blackmailer, with the Savannah who had nursed Joy so tenderly when she came home from the hospital.
Keep it, said Troy viciously. We just want you out of our lives.
That was my intention, said Savannah. She stood and picked up her handbag, the new one Joy had bought for her with the crossover strap. I mean, to get out of your lives. This was only ever temporary. She sounded like she was trying not to cry, and Joy knew perfectly well that it could be fake emotion or someone else's emotion she was channeling for her own purposes. But her heart still broke for her. Only ever temporary. Was that the way this child lived her whole life? This child who had been starving in their midst and they'd shouted at her, ignored her, refused to help her? Joy remembered how she'd slammed the laundry door with her foot. She couldn't see the child's face in her memory, just the outline of a little girl, her features a blur, but she could certainly remember the savagery with which she'd slammed the door in a child's face. They hadn't known she was hungry. How could they have known? But Joy prided herself on being observant. She wanted to go back in time and do all the things the sort of person she thought she was would have done. Feed the kid, listen to her, rescue her from her awful childhood.
Well, said Joy, you don't need to go right away.
Mum, said Brooke, I think she probably does need to go right away.
Yeah, said Savannah.
She looked at Joy's children.
It's been a blast, guys.
Where will you go? Asked Amy.
She's fine, said Troy abruptly. She's got money.
I am fine, said Savannah. I'll be back at some point to pick up my stuff. She smiled radiantly at Joy, and now she was a dinner party guest taking her leave.
Thank you so much for your hospitality.
It's been my pleasure, said Joy automatically, but truthfully, because up until tonight, it had been her pleasure. Her absolute pleasure. For an excruciating moment, they all held their positions, as if they were actors in a terrible theatre production and someone had forgotten their lines. Joy wouldn't have been surprised to hear an audience member cough. "I'm very sorry," said Savannah suddenly, her eyes bright with unshed tears. Joy would never know if they were real or fake, if she truly was or wasn't sorry, because Savannah suddenly patted the side of her handbag decisively, drew herself up, and left the room. Left the house. Exit stage left. Just like Stan. She disappeared into the dark night, from where she'd first come. Chapter 47. Now. "That was the last time I saw Savannah," said Troy Delaney. "Did she return the money?" asked Christina. Detective Senior Constable Christina Khoury was in what her mother would describe as a tetchy mood. She didn't have a body like she thought she'd had the day before. The call had come through almost immediately. "Not yours. Skeletal remains." This woman had died at least 30 years previously, back when Christina was a child, trying to decide whether she wanted to be a police officer or a marine biologist when she grew up. And why had she not stuck with marine biology? She could have been floating about looking at starfish right now. Furthermore, a member of Joy Delaney's tennis club, a Fiona Reed, had just called in with the wonderful news that she'd seen Joy yesterday afternoon, getting off the train at Central, looking as hale and healthy as could be. Although sadly, she hadn't seemed to hear her name when Fiona called out to her. "Because it wasn't her, you fool," thought Christina. Meanwhile, a psychic had just gone public with the news that her feeling was that Joy was alive, but being held captive, somewhere near water, or possibly in the desert. Christina did still have her motive. Joy Delaney's hairdresser, Narelle Longford, had contacted police the moment she heard about yesterday's discovery of the body, and she had shared all the information that her client had ever shared with her, including the story of a decades-old secret revealed last year by their young houseguest, who was not, in fact, a random stranger at all. Stan's children had shared precisely none of this with Christina. They knew it made their father look bad and had chosen to say nothing up until now. Christina studied Joy Delaney's second son, a good-looking man buffed by money and success, no doubt adored by his mother, but a man who had fallen with absurd ease for a young woman's blackmail. She and Ethan were talking to him in his luxury apartment. The blindingly beautiful views from the huge windows were an irritation, like distractingly loud music. She found herself wanting to say, "Can't you turn that down a notch?" "She actually did return the money," said Troy. "She sent me a check in the post. I tore it up. Never banked it." He shifted slightly in his chair, which looked spindly and cheap to Christina, like an office chair from the 1950s, but which was apparently something to be impressed by, according to Ethan, who had asked Troy if it was a genuine something or other, and it was a genuine something or other. Why even bother asking? Troy was the sort of guy who took pride in overpaying for everything, even blackmail. "I suspect it would have bounced, but I don't know that for sure." "Why didn't you bank it?" asked Christina. "After she left, I started to feel sorry for her," said Troy. He tapped a beautifully manicured thumbnail against his teeth. "She'd obviously had a troubled childhood, and we were all cruel to her when she came to our house as a child. Unwittingly cruel to her, but still, we were. And the more I thought about her, the more I realised how much we had in common."
What did you have in common?
Both our fathers chose Harry Haddad over us, said Troy. He smiled wryly, as if he wanted to give the impression that it didn't matter now, but he couldn't quite pull it off, the childish pain still visible. She said something about how painful it was whenever Harry was on television, and I feel exactly the same way. I always change the channel whenever I see that guy's smug face.
Just to clarify, is anyone in your family in contact with Harry Haddad? Asked Christina.
Not that I know of, said Troy, the distaste clear on his face.
And this Savannah is estranged from her brother, as far as you know?
As far as I know. I would think if she had anything to do with her brother, she'd go to him for money.
That didn't necessarily follow. Christina wrote down, interview Harry Haddad. It would probably tell them nothing, and celebrities took their time returning phone calls, but it was another box that needed ticking.
So Savannah left, and your parents never heard from her again?
About a month after she left, this young couple showed up with a van and said Savannah had sent them to collect her stuff. Mum said they were hippie types. She said they barely said a word, and they seemed terrified of Mum, so God knows what weird story Savannah fed them.
And that was it? No other contact from her?
As far as I know, said Troy. His knees jiggled. He pressed his hands to his thighs to still them, as if they belonged to someone else.
I assume there must have been some fallout after this revelation about what your mother had done. Presumably your father felt...
She paused, in the hope that he might fill in the word. He said nothing, so she gave him some options.
Angry? Hurt?
Troy didn't pick a word. He said carefully, possibly.
That moment he first heard, said Christina. What did he do? Did he lose his temper? Shout? Swear?
My father never shouts when he is truly angry, said Troy. He left. He just walked off. That is his... coping mechanism, I guess.
Where did he go?
Well, this time he didn't get very far. He was walking, about 10 minutes from the house. He fell, a pothole. He dislocated his kneecap, tore his meniscus. Fortunately, someone we knew was driving by and drove him home. He already had problem knees, so that was pretty bad.
No more tennis? Asked Ethan.
He was told no tennis for at least 6 months. Troy unconsciously put one hand to his own knee, although he always defies expectations.
That must have upset him, said Christina.
Tennis is his life, said Troy with feeling.
So no more tennis for your mother either then, said Christina, thinking of how often people had gone on about the wondrousness of the Delaney's marriage because they played doubles.
Well, actually, my mother started playing in a singles comp, said Troy.
Without your father, said Christina.
My mother was a top-ranked singles player when she was a teenager, said Troy obliviously. He seemed to be missing the symbolism. She competed in her first Australian nationals when she was only 14. She beat Margaret.
Got it,
said Christina before she heard the woman's full CV. So your mother is out playing tennis while your father is stuck at home doing nothing, unable to play the sport he loves, feeling betrayed by his wife. I would assume it wasn't exactly a happy household.
I guess not, said Troy. I don't know. I was busy with my own life.
He looked up at the ceiling for a moment and then back at Christina. I thought everything had gone back to normal, although I will admit.
He stopped and she saw him swallow, an involuntary, convulsive swallow.
On Christmas Day, I did think, it kind of shocked me that I would think this.
He stopped again and Christina gritted her teeth.
Up until now, he'd been answering her questions in a comfortable, urbane manner, like a successful man being interviewed for a magazine profile. But now his veneer had slipped. She wanted to grab him by his stylish linen shirt and yell, "Just tell me, your dad did it. We all know he did it."
His hands were locked as if in prayer. For the first time in my life, I thought.
He looked at her pleadingly as if he needed exoneration.
"What did you think?"
Christina weighted her voice with authority.
"That my parents might truly hate each other."
He turned his gaze back to his shiny harbour view.
"It was mutual, by the way. The hatred was mutual."
Chapter 48.
I told the police what happened on Christmas Day.
"What do you mean?
Nothing happened on Christmas Day."
"Oh, come on, Brooke.
Nothing relevant happened."
Jacob Azinovich could hear voices, loud and clear, as he walked around the side of the Delaney house carrying a slow-cooked lamb casserole.
"I need you to take this over to Stan Delaney for me," his mother had said when he came over to check out the mysterious beeping sound her car had been making, although it was suspiciously silent when Jacob drove it.
"Why do I have to take it over?" protested Jacob. This was the real reason he'd been summoned, to walk over the road and deliver a casserole.
"Jacob," said Caro, "it's possible that man murdered his wife."
"Then why are you cooking for him?"
"Innocent until proven guilty," said Caro. "Stan has been very nice to me since your father died. Joy would expect me to send over a meal."
"Not if Stan killed her, she wouldn't," said Jacob. But his mother's eyes had welled with tears, so he sighed and picked up the baking dish and headed out the door.
"I overcooked it," his mother called out as he left. "Just in case."
No one answered when he knocked on the Delaneys' front door, but he could see that the driveway was filled with cars, so he'd come around the side of the house. All four Delaney children were there, sitting at a table on the back veranda, talking animatedly and loudly. Jacob felt that familiar sense of awed trepidation he used to feel when he'd seen them together as children. There was a kind of glamorous violence to the Delaney siblings. At any moment, a monumental battle could erupt.
"They know all about Savannah now," said Troy. His luxuriant, dark, curly hair looked like he'd been running his fingers through it.
Troy was the first boy Jacob had ever loved, his first experience of a flirtatious straight boy.
"They know what Mum and Dad were arguing about now. They know Dad has a motive."
Jacob cleared his throat to make his presence known and shifted the casserole. It was hot against his forearms.
"Don't use the word motive," said Brooke. "It is not a motive. Did you tell them about Savannah? I thought we'd agreed not to mention the Harry Haddad connection at all."
"I never agreed to anything, but it wasn't me. It was Mum's hairdresser," said Troy. "They're trying to get in touch with Harry."
"I don't see what Harry could tell them," said Logan.
He rubbed his eyes with his knuckles.
Savannah was estranged from him.
Did you think it was Mum? Asked Amy. She spoke in a dreamy kind of voice. When you heard about the body on the news?
Oh, God, this was an awful conversation to overhear. Still, no one noticed Jacob.
Hi, guys,
he said with a crack in his voice, not nearly loud enough. He'd forgotten how you had to up your volume when all the Delaneys were together.
No, I did not think it was her, said Logan, not for a minute. She's fine.
It's too long now, said Troy. She's been gone too long. We need to forget the whole Mum is making a point theory.
All we can do is support Dad, said Brooke.
Not if he murdered our mother, we can't, said Troy.
Brooke said, shh. She pointed at the back door of the house. Presumably Stan was inside.
Don't say things like that. People can tell you have suspicions or doubts or whatever the hell you've got. They're analysing our body language online. When we had the media conference, you and Amy stepped away from Dad. It looked bad.
I was not stepping away from Dad, said Amy. I felt dizzy. I thought I was going to faint.
If you're so worried about optics, maybe you should have got Dad to join the search party, said Troy to Brooke.
Dad thought it was a waste of time, said Brooke. He said there wasn't a snowflake's chance in hell Mum would have ridden in the reserve because she wrote to the council saying it was the wrong place for a bike track and she never forgave them for not listening to her.
Mum does get offended when the council don't listen to her recommendations, commented Amy.
Do you even care about Mum?
Troy suddenly turned on Brooke and Jacob flinched at the fury on his face.
Are you even worried?
Of course she cares, said Amy. Don't be so mean to her.
I'm frantic about Mum.
Brooke spoke through clenched teeth at her brother. She didn't seem at all intimidated by Troy's fury.
It seems like you're more worried about setting Dad up with a fucking lawyer.
It's just in case, said Logan to Troy. Dad doesn't even want a lawyer.
In case what? Cried Troy. In case he's guilty of murder.
Jacob was frozen on the spot, his hands slippery under the baking dish.
She's my mother too, hissed Brooke.
She slammed her fist so hard on the table that it rocked, and Logan had to catch the side to stop it falling.
You live half your life in America and don't even call her for weeks on end.
I call her all the time.
You do not.
Well, the truth is, none of us had called her lately, murmured Amy, at the same time as Logan sighed heavily and said, This is getting us nowhere.
Troy stood up abruptly. He did a double take when he saw Jacob standing on the lawn like a loon.
Hi, Jacob.
Sorry, said Jacob idiotically. I didn't mean to interrupt. Mum asked me to bring this casserole for your dad.
He held it out as proof, and the glass lid wobbled alarmingly.
My mother overcooked it on the off chance your dad is a murderer.
Whoa!
Troy stepped off the veranda and grabbed the baking dish from him. That's really nice of your mum. Tell her thank you.
I'll get Dad for you, said Amy. We're all just waiting for him to clean up. He's inside, painting the bathroom.
Like you do, said Troy.
He held the baking dish easily under one arm like a football. When your wife is missing.
Great time to renovate.
Jesus, Troy, said Logan under his breath.
Don't disturb your dad. I'll leave you to it.
Jacob backed away fast.
I hope you get good news soon. He held up two tightly crossed fingers, like a fool. The four Delaney siblings looked back at him gravely. They did not look like people expecting good news anytime soon. They looked like people waiting for a funeral to start. As he walked back to his mother's place, he wondered what could have happened last Christmas that was either relevant or irrelevant to the police. He'd been here visiting his mother at Christmas. He had not heard or seen anything untoward from across the road. His thoughts turned to a long-ago Christmas day when he was around 10 or 11, and he somehow ended up at the Delaney's place, umpiring a late afternoon doubles match between the four siblings, who had all received various types of tennis gear for Christmas that they wanted to try out. "Don't let my awful children take advantage of you, Jacob," Joy had called out. But Jacob loved umpiring the Delaney matches. He knew all the rules because his dad was a sports nut, and so Jacob was a sports nut too. He felt as powerful as God up there on the high umpire's chair, with a bird's eye view, able to see every mistake. He put on a loud, grave voice, imitating the umpires on TV, and the Delaneys didn't even make fun of him. They appreciated the effort. It was Logan and Brooke playing Troy and Amy, and at that time they were evenly matched, although they shouldn't have been, because Brooke, although clearly talented, was just a little kid, and Amy was a teen, an incredible player. But Amy was hampered by Troy, who made stupid errors in between flashes of brilliance, and they were up against Logan, who at 14 had the power and speed of a man and made the court look small. The match went on and on until Jacob's dad came over to collect him because dinner was on the table. But then his dad, being his dad, got caught up in the match. Joy and Stan set up picnic chairs. The two grandmothers trotted out in high heels carrying gin and tonics and cigarettes. Stan gave Jacob's dad a beer. The sky turned pink. The four children played as if lives were at stake. Jacob couldn't remember who won. He just remembered their passion and their talent. He still loved witnessing the combination of passion and talent in any endeavour, whether it was sport or musical theatre. The grown-ups were respectfully silent during each rally and then applauded like they were watching a grand slam. The Delaney kids fed off their applause. They punched the air. They roared with delight. They fell to their knees. It felt like Jacob was part of something big and important. "Remarkable family," Jacob's dad marvelled on their way back across the road to a cold dinner and a rather cross mother. "Your umpiring was top-notch, Jacob." It occurred to Jacob that a man who could take such pleasure in watching someone else's children compete in a backyard tennis match would probably have quite liked at least one athletic child of his own, rather than the two uncoordinated academic kids he got. It said something about his dad that it had taken Jacob 34 years for that thought to occur to him. "Your umpiring was top-notch, Jacob." Just when he thought he had a handle on this grief business, it walloped him, as if he'd only just got the news. He pressed the back of a hand that still smelled like lamb casserole to his mouth, and a small white butterfly fluttered by so close he felt its wings brush against his cheek. His mother believed every passing butterfly was his dad stopping to say hello, which was convenient because there were plenty of butterflies in this leafy suburb. "Hi, Dad," thought Jacob. He didn't believe the butterfly was his dad, but still, just in case. He watched the butterfly sail up above his mother's front door. It hovered under the eaves, right next to the small metal bracket where his mother's security camera usually hung. It had been smashed by a hailstone in the storm a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, I know, Dad. Thanks for the reminder. I'm getting it fixed. I'll pick it up.
Then he stopped in his tracks. He turned around and looked back at the Delaney's house and wondered what mistakes that camera might have witnessed from way up there with its bird's eye view.
Chapter 49. Christmas Day.
That is the creepiest Santa I've ever seen, said Troy to Amy.
They sat side by side drinking champagne on the three-seater dark brown leather couch in their parents' living room, watching a miniature Santa Claus gyrate his hips to Santa Claus Rock on the coffee table.
He's leering at me, said Amy.
Don't turn him off, said Logan as he set up a stepladder under a light fitting to change a globe. I suggested Santa might appreciate a break, and Mum called me a Grinch.
It was the first time they'd all been together since the dramatic confrontation with Savannah back in October, and it was also the first time in years that the Delaneys had celebrated Christmas with just the immediate family. No in-laws, no partners, no random friends or second cousins. No strangers who turned out not to be strangers. In fact, thought Amy as she chugged back her second glass of champagne on an empty stomach, an extremely empty stomach, it was possible this was their first Delaney Christmas ever with just the six of them, because growing up, they'd always had the two grandmothers at Christmas lunch, gently lobbing passive-aggressive compliments back and forth across the table. It felt pointless celebrating without other people, as if the whole objective had always been to perform the festivities for an audience. Why bother with any of it now? No one was religious, and there were no children to become sugared up and adorably excited about Santa. Yet Amy's mother appeared to be on a crazed mission to make this the Christmassiest Christmas of Delaney family history. She decorated the already cluttered house with a quite extraordinary volume of newly purchased Christmas decorations. Shimmering lengths of tinsel had been thrown indiscriminately along windowsills. A series of identical grinning snowmen ornaments were precariously perched on top of the signed tennis ball collection. A nativity scene had been crammed in the middle of the tennis trophies so that Amy could see the surprised face of baby Jesus reflected in a Bundaberg Seniors Mixed Doubles Tournament trophy. Baubles hung from door handles. There was reindeer-shaped soap in the bathroom. Steffi had been forced to wear jingly gold bells tied to her collar, which she clearly found mortifying. Right now she sat beneath the coffee table with her head between her paws, morosely munching on a piece of Christmas wrapping paper with the gift label still visible. It said, "To Troy from Mum and Dad. With love." Joy wore a new red dress and flashing Christmas tree earrings and was whirling about the kitchen, preparing an incredibly elaborate hot lunch that was clearly beyond her capabilities. No one was allowed to help her with anything. They had been instructed they must not bring anything except themselves and alcohol. They were busy people with their own lives. "I'm not a busy person with my own life," Amy had protested, but she hadn't even been allowed to make brownies. When they'd arrived 3 hours ago, they'd been told to remain in the living room where they should all sit back and relax. It was extremely stressful.
"Why didn't you bring your toy boy along today?"
Troy removed a piece of red tinsel from Amy's hair. He himself had a fetching dusting of gold glitter on his cheekbone, but Amy didn't tell him. She thought it suited him. He looked like a rock star.
"He's just a friend," said Amy.
"Sure he is," said Troy.
Simon's parents lived in the country, on a cattle farm, of all the horrifying places to live, and Simon had gone to spend the Christmas break with them. He had invited Amy to come, but meeting his family at Christmas would obviously give him the impression she was a normal girlfriend, and she very nearly had a panic attack just imagining all that endless space.
I feel like we're missing someone.
Troy looked about him with dissatisfaction, holding his champagne glass by the stem.
It doesn't feel like Christmas, in spite of all this horror.
He gestured at the decorations. I know, said Amy. I was just thinking the same thing. I keep looking about for the missing person.
I think it's Indira who is missing, said Troy. I miss Indira.
Me too, said Amy.
Indira was a great Christmas guest because she hadn't celebrated it growing up and therefore had no rules or expectations or baggage about the holiday. She always got a little drunk and sang carols beautifully. None of the Delaneys could hold a note, so they were rapturous in their appreciation. Also, she would have found a way to convince Joy to let her into the kitchen to help.
Did you hear that? Troy called across the room to Logan. We miss your girlfriend.
Logan ignored them as he unscrewed the old light globe.
Get Indira back, cried Amy. I command it, peasant.
One of their favourite games when they were kids involved Amy's siblings agreeing to be her peasants. Well, it was one of her favourite games. They all had to do what she commanded and fetch her things. She could never quite believe she got away with it. She could still remember the sick, delicious feeling of power as she watched Brooke obediently make her bed. Logan didn't even bother to respond. Her power was long gone. Troy lowered his voice.
I don't especially miss Grant.
I miss his roast potatoes, said Amy.
He was so fucking proud of them, said Troy.
Deservedly so, said Amy. Hey, have you noticed how Brooke is?
I can hear you both, said Brooke from the floor next to the couch,
where she was lying flat on her back on the purple floral carpet doing some weird kind of pretzel-like stretch. Brooke had worn a summer dress to please their mother, who said, Oh, that looks nice, although I thought you'd wear your lovely green one today.
Amy had at least made an effort to get the colour code right by wearing a vintage green miniskirt and a red singlet top. Her mother said,
My goodness, you look like a gangster's girlfriend.
The boys wore the same clothes they always wore, and their mother told both of them they looked gorgeous.
Eavesdropping peasant, Amy kicked her sister with her foot. You've forgotten the revolution.
Brooke stretched one hamstring and then the other.
We are no longer your peasants.
She was Brooke again. That's what Amy had been going to say. Have you noticed how Brooke is Brooke again? She was back doing random yoga poses and floor stretches. She snorted when she laughed. She talked about lowbrow stuff like The Bachelor. She actually looked taller. Maybe she'd been subconsciously hunching for Grant.
Girls, you must never hunch for a boy, their mother used to cry, which was all very well for her.
Brooke sat up, her dress bunched up around her knees.
Bum shuffle. Ordered Amy. Be cute, like you used to be.
She's still cute, said Troy.
Brooke tried to shuffle along the carpet on her bottom, but couldn't do it. I'll get carpet burn, she said. She put her hands flat on the monstrous carpet.
When Dad dies, how fast do you think Mum will tear this up?
His body will still be warm, said Troy.
Amy shuddered. That's horrible.
Mum should just get people in and do it, said Troy.
Imagine how much better this room would look with beautiful floorboards.
Dad keeps saying he's happy to tear it up, said Logan. I've said I'll do it, but then he always changes his mind at the last minute.
It's because Grandma was so proud of it, said Amy. They used to call this the good room. She worked all those hours to save up to get this carpet after Dad's father left, and she thought this colour was so fashionable.
Grandma chose this colour, marvelled Brooke.
Imagine actually choosing it.
She stretched her legs either side of her in a V-shape and dropped her forehead to the horrible carpet.
Ouch! Amy shuddered. Don't do that.
You three all need to stretch more, said Brooke without lifting her head. Hey, did I tell you I've joined a basketball team?
Seriously? Said Logan from his perch.
Thought I'd try a new sport, said Brooke into the carpet. Amy and her brothers all exchanged glances. There was no other sport besides tennis.
I always wondered how I'd go in a team sport, said Troy.
Tennis is lonely.
Because you're such a team player, said Logan.
I'm good at basketball, said Brooke.
Of course you are, said Amy.
There was an ominous clatter and crash from the kitchen.
Do you think we should try again to help Mum?
Brooke stretched even lower, her voice muffled by the carpet.
I'm pretty hungry.
Yes, I'm actually feeling quite faint. Troy put the back of his hand to his forehead.
She yelled at me last time I went into the kitchen.
Logan hopped down from the ladder.
Do you think she'd notice if we ordered a pizza?
I opened the oven to check the turkey and she smacked me across the back.
Brooke sat back up, her face flushed.
She literally smacked me.
She pointed at Troy.
You've got glitter on your face.
Leave it. It looks nice, said Amy.
What's Dad doing? Interrupted Brooke.
He's in his office, answered Amy, watching reruns of Harry's matches. She'd stood at the door and watched him, his head bent, his massive shoulders hunched, murmuring to himself as he took notes for God knew what purpose.
Obviously thrilled to spend Christmas with his beloved family, said Troy.
It's because of Harry's comeback. He's obsessed, said Amy.
This seems to be a new level of obsession, said Logan. Now he knows what Mum did.
Yep, he'll never forgive her for taking away his golden boy, said Troy lightly. He refilled his champagne glass and held up the flute to the light.
They aren't talking, said Brooke. They're not even looking at each other.
It's upsetting, said Amy. And she thought she spoke idly, the way anyone would speak if their parents weren't talking on Christmas Day. But she saw her siblings straighten and tense. Looks were exchanged, unspoken warnings shared. This was the way it had been ever since the year of suicidal thoughts. She'd been 14. Everybody had suicidal thoughts at 14. Unfortunately, Amy had written long, heartfelt goodbye letters to each member of her family, which had been discovered, roundly mocked, and never, ever forgotten. Brooke said she still had hers on file, which was mortifying. Amy had misspelled the word melancholy. Such was the paradoxical nature of sibling relationships. They could tease her for the sappiness and spelling of her suicide notes while being terrified she'd write new ones.
You mustn't get worked up about it, said Brooke carefully, as though Amy were teetering on the edge of a bridge.
I'm not suicidal. It's just upsetting, snapped Amy.
Brooke held up her hands. Got it.
I'm not 10. If they get a divorce, they get a divorce.
She could hardly bear to think of it. Her parents living in different homes, trying out new hairstyles and hobbies, new relationships. In truth, she felt exactly the same way she would have felt if they'd divorced when she was 10.
Surely they're too old to divorce, said Brooke. What would be the point?
They're not that old, said Logan. It happens.
I should have got them a marriage counselling gift certificate for Christmas, said Troy thoughtfully. He'd got their mother a bike. You could tell it was a bike, even though every inch of it was beautifully wrapped in gold paper.
A bike!
Their mother had cried, both hands to her heart as he carried it in. How did you know I wanted a bike?
Troy mysteriously always knew what everyone wanted.
I must eat, said Amy. Brooke, go tell Mum we have to eat something now because you're getting a migraine.
You tell her you have to eat because you're having a panic attack, retorted Brooke.
Tell her Logan is hungry, said Troy. She won't want Logan to be hungry. I told her I was hungry an hour ago, said Logan.
Steffi came out from under the coffee table and put her head on Amy's lap.
What's the latest with Claire?
Amy asked Troy as she stroked Steffi's soft ears.
Troy's ex-wife had been back in Australia trying to get pregnant with their frozen embryos, and so far she'd been through one round with no luck.
She's having a break, trying again in the new year, said Troy. There are four more left.
Do you hope that she does get pregnant? Asked Amy. Or that she doesn't?
I want it for her. I don't want it for me. I don't want that guy bringing up my biological child. I really, really don't want that.
He paused.
Did I tell you I met him?
The cardiologist? Asked Brooke. What's he like?
They all looked at Troy, waiting for his answer, staunchly on his side in spite of their sniping, in spite of his past mistakes, suddenly, mysteriously, as close as siblings could be.
Amy remembered that awful day when their father got out of the car on the highway.
One moment they'd all been fighting, hating each other as hard as you can possibly hate a sibling, and then suddenly the car was silent, and Troy was holding Brooke's hand and they were looking at each other, waiting for their mother's response, united in their horror.
He's an arrogant twat, said Troy.
That's surgeons for you, said Brooke.
He's not right for her, said Troy.
He calls Claire baby. She's trying to have a baby and he calls her baby.
Brooke said, I mean, I guess that's a common term of...
The kitchen fire alarm began to beep. An acrid smell filled the house and their father limped heavily into the room, radiating grumpiness. One of the grinning snowmen toppled from the shelf and onto the carpet.
What's going on? Demanded Stan.
He looked at them all as if they were children.
It's fine! Joy shrieked from the kitchen. Everything is fine. Just relax. Everybody stay right where you are.
Joy threw a tea towel up at the smoke detector on her kitchen ceiling to try to make it stop beeping. She wished Logan had never installed the damn thing. It was so sensitive, so judgmental of her cooking.
It's not an actual fire, she told the smoke detector.
She caught the tea towel and tossed it up again. It was a bad throw. It landed splat on her face. She twisted it into a ball and threw it again.
It's just a bit of smoke, you stupid thing. Stop overreacting.
She'd been doing walnuts in butter and brown sugar like Savannah had done on Father's Day. She told Joy that salad was a cinch. And then she'd been distracted, trying to stir the stupid lumps out of the gravy, and next thing the walnuts were black, smoking chunks of nuclear waste. No warning, no middle ground. Lunch kept slipping further and further away. Her children wouldn't stop interrupting to ask if they could help, and she didn't want their help, because then they'd all get involved and start making annoying suggestions and ordering her around. Don't bother with the walnuts, Mum. Isn't it time to put the potatoes on?
It felt like she was stuck in one of those recurring nightmares she still had, where she was trying to get one of her children to a match on time, but her car was moving in slow motion. She'd wake with her foot still desperately pressing an imaginary accelerator. She threw the saucepan straight in the bin. It was ruined forever. Everything was ruined forever. What in the world was she trying to prove with this elaborate lunch and all these fancy, fiddly side dishes? No one in her family even liked turkey or walnuts.
She'd created a picture in her head of a glittering, red, golden, green Christmas day that would somehow magically make them a family again.
Are we ever going to eat today?
Stan was in the kitchen, glowering at her. It was the first time he'd spoken directly to her in weeks, and this was what he chose to say.
Well, that's lovely, she said. Not, can I do anything to help, but are we ever going to eat today?
Everyone has been offering to help, and you refuse to accept, said Stan.
She said, everyone has not offered to help.
You have not offered to help?
I am very happy to do anything if it will finally get lunch on the table. I am at your disposal.
I am at your disposal.
It was like seeing his damned mother come back to life. She used to sit in this kitchen, exhaling a long stream of cigarette smoke with amused, malicious eyes while Joy cooked, feeling stupid and banal and talking too much. Joy didn't know she was going to do it before she did it. She picked up the first of his mother's sneering china cats and threw it with the power of a first serve against the wall, decapitating it cleanly. She picked up the second one and did the same. It caught the edge of the kitchen cupboard and sent a glittering shower of hand-painted china across the bench. There was silence.
Feel better? Drawled Stan with his mother's cruel contempt. Or do I need to pass you another ornament?
The smoke alarm once again began to beep its thin, sharp, insistent warning of danger ahead. Chapter 50. Now. So then my father stomped out of the kitchen. Well, he sort of stomp-limped because of his bad knee and went back into his office and slammed the door. It turned out Mum had smashed these two ornaments that belonged to my father's mother.
Oh, dear. Did they have sentimental value to your father? Asked Roger Strout.
Spot on, Roger, said Amy.
Sometimes he suspected she was gently teasing him. Roger Strout was a former automotive fleet sales executive who had accepted a redundancy package 2 years ago, completed a diploma of counselling, and was now offering talk therapy 6 days a week. His ex-wife thought that was appalling because who in their right mind would accept help from Roger, of all people? No wonder there was a mental health crisis in this country. In fact, a lot of people not in their right mind would accept help from Roger, of all people, because, yes, there was a mental health crisis in this country and people from all walks of life were desperate for help. He was booked up 3 months in advance. He was well aware of the limitations of his qualifications and experience and scrupulous about never describing his clients as his patients, because it wasn't a doctor-patient relationship. It was a collaboration. Right now, Roger and Amy sat opposite each other in the matching oversized fabric-covered wing chairs with the brass stud detailing on the arms that all clients touched with their fingertips when they were about to tell him something important. Amy's blue-dyed hair was tied back in the tightest, tidiest ponytail he'd ever seen her wear, as if this was one area of her life over which she could maintain control. At their last appointment, she'd mentioned that her mother had sent an unexpected text message saying she was going off-grid. Amy had spent the session talking about how she'd like to go off-grid herself, maybe move to a small country town where everyone knew her name, except she really hated the country. She hadn't shown up for the appointment after that, and then, last week, Roger had got the shock of his life when he saw Amy with her siblings on the local evening news appealing for information about their missing mother. So then my father refused to eat Christmas lunch with us, which my mother finally served at around 4 p.m, by which time we were all starving and quite drunk, and, well, it was a very dysfunctional Christmas day. But you know, that happens in lots of families, doesn't it?
Christmas can be stressful, said Roger, who had begun Christmas Day with an early morning screaming match with his ex-wife about the agreed handover time for their two children. Festive indeed.
None of us were exactly in a rush for another family event, and we were all busy and distracted over January. I'm not saying we lost contact with our parents. I mean, how often do you visit your parents, Roger?
Roger made a non-committal sound.
Amy preferred not to play by the therapy rules and instead pretended they were old friends catching up for a chat. She tried to catch him out by shooting abrupt personal questions at him, which he normally managed to dodge. The answer was that he had dinner with his parents every Sunday night, without fail.
"But you're an only child," she said.
He had no memory of sharing this information.
"See, because there are four of us, we all assumed that someone had been over to the house. Brooke and Logan are always over there, except apparently they weren't for a few weeks, which they could have mentioned."
She said this with the cheerful, childish disdain with which siblings often spoke about each other. Roger had a client who was an extremely well-spoken university lecturer, except for when she talked about her older sister, when she morphed into a freckled, pigtailed kid.
"My sister gets everything, Roger."
Normally, Mum is the one organising family events, or she drops by or suggests coffee, and so it took us a while to notice she wasn't in touch, continued Amy. "Also, it's not like Mum and Dad are incapacitated. They're so active. They're more active than me." Amy plucked at the fabric of her pants. "Mum isn't even 70 yet. They keep describing her in the papers as an elderly woman. She's not elderly. They should try returning her first serve when she's in a bad mood." She smiled tremulously at the thought of her mother's serve. "My brothers and sister and I worked out that when we got that text from Mum, it had been a whole week since any of us had had any contact from her, which seems wrong. I mean, she is a little bit elderly." She used her fingertips to massage her cheeks. "My jaw aches. I've been clenching it ever since we filed the missing persons report." She opened and shut her mouth a few times. "I keep thinking about my rabbit dream." She looked at him expectantly.
"Your rabbit dream?" said Roger. "You sure had to be on your toes with Amy. You know, my recurring rabbit dream?"
"Oh, yes, I remember," said Roger. "Where you forget to feed your rabbit."
"I forget that I have a rabbit. And in my dream, I suddenly remember, oh my God, I have a rabbit. And I'm walking out to the rabbit hutch in the backyard and I know the rabbit is going to be dead."
She shuddered as if at a real memory of a terrible mistake. She lowered her voice and met his eyes. "Sometimes it's not a rabbit, it's a puppy, which is worse, although I don't know why. That's so unfair to rabbits." She put her hand to her collarbone as her chest rose and fell rapidly. "Your parents don't require you to feed them, Amy," said Roger. "They're not bunnies or puppies or children. They're grown-ups. It was your mother's prerogative to go off-grid." Assuming she actually sent the text. Roger had read the news stories. He knew her mother's phone had been found in the house, meaning someone else could have sent the text. He wondered if his limitations were about to be tested beyond their capabilities, because it seemed possible, if not probable, that Amy's father had killed her mother. Even someone with the most robust mental health would find that traumatic.
"By the way, you'll be pleased to hear I broke up with my flatmate," she said abruptly. "Not that we were ever really going out. It was just sex."
She shot him a look as if she were hoping to shock him.
"Why would you think I'd be pleased about that?" asked Roger.
"He's far too nice for me," said Amy. "He's been so supportive about my missing mother. I felt like I was building up this debt I could never pay off. Like a mortgage. I could never have a mortgage."
"Well, you know," said Roger, "a relationship is about..."
Amy said, "I wasn't worried at first about Mum when we didn't hear from her. I was pleased. I thought, good for you. Your turn now."
Roger took a moment. He didn't get it.
"What do you mean, your turn now?"
"It was like what my dad used to do. When I was a kid, I always used to think, why doesn't she just walk out?"
Roger wrote down, "Father, walking out?" But he didn't speak. He could sense the words banked up in her. "I was angry every time Dad left," she massaged her jaw, "but I was even angrier with Mum for putting up with it." Roger waited. "But I don't know. What if Dad did do what people are saying?" She looked at him imploringly. "What if it was an accident? Because my grandfather, what he did to my grandmother, it could be genetic, because that was a terrible thing that Mum did. Harry was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for my dad. You only get one chance like that. I always knew how much Harry leaving hurt Dad. I knew he never really got over it. I could see it whenever Harry's name came up. And then we find out that it was actually Mum. All along, it was Mum." Roger wrote down, "Grandfather? Harry? One chance?" He couldn't grab onto a thread of the conversation so he could make sense of it. "But if Dad did, I mean, I couldn't forgive him. What if he asks for my forgiveness? How could I forgive him? But he's my dad. How can I abandon him? What if he asked me to be a character witness in court?" She was rolling down a steep, slippery slope of potential catastrophes. "Whose witness would I be? How do I choose a side? Do I visit him in jail? How can you visit your mother's murderer in jail? You can't." The words dried up. All he could hear was ragged, desperate panic. Her eyes met his in mute terror. Watching someone have a panic attack was like looking into the eyes of someone trapped behind glass, drowning right in front of you. "Breathe with me." Roger put down his notepad and picked up the carved wooden figure of an elephant that sat next to the tissue box. "Focus on this. Feel the curve of its trunk. Focus on the smoothness, the roughness." He watched her hands trace the elephant's textured surface. "Tiger," whispered Amy, and for a moment he didn't get it. He thought, it's an elephant, not a tiger. Was it something to do with the bunny dream? But then he remembered how at their very first session she teased him about how every therapist she'd ever seen wanted to talk about the tiger when they described the fight or flight response. The saber-toothed tiger. She was trying to tell him it was here, leaping for her throat. Chapter 51. "No criminal record," said Christina. "No evidence of violence or threats of violence. No life insurance policy." "There's still a financial benefit," Ethan pointed out. "They were cashed up from selling the tennis school. He'd be in a better position financially than if they divorced. I'm not talking about the Delaneys. I'm saying he could have said all of the above about this charmer." She jabbed a finger at the newspaper on her desk. The body found in bushland had been identified as Polly Perkins. Polly was a woman who'd lived in a suburb close to Joy Delaney. 30 years ago, Polly's husband told everyone his wife had left him and gone back to New Zealand. She'd left a cold, hurtful note. The neighbouring women had been sad for him. They'd brought around casseroles and carrot cake. The truth was that Professor Andrew Perkins had hit his first wife, Polly, over the head with a new Sunbeam steam iron after he had expressly forbidden her from buying it because he was under significant financial stress at the time. His full, frank confession included the rueful admission that he really hadn't intended to hit her quite that hard. He'd buried his wife's body in bushland within a short drive of his home. If it wasn't for the landslide caused by the storm, Polly would be there still. Polly had been estranged from a scattered, dysfunctional family, but there had been a missing persons report filed by her best friend in New Zealand. Over the years, this friend had valiantly tried to get the Australian police interested in her missing friend, to little avail. Records showed just one visit by police officers to the Perkins house 3 years after Polly left. The two officers had enjoyed some carrot cake baked by the kind neighbour who had become Andrew Perkins's second wife. The second wife had used the murder weapon to iron her husband's shirts for a good 20 years before being given permission to buy a new one. She had this week told police about an ongoing pattern of financial, verbal, and physical abuse that had left her a prisoner in her home. This man enjoyed 30 years of freedom after he murdered his wife. He could easily have gone to his grave without justice. Christina pressed her thumb on Polly's husband's murderous, well-fed face. We may not have Joy Delaney's body yet, but... Her phone rang. It was probably just as well. There had been too much emotion in her voice. It was Constable Pete Novak, the ground search coordinator. We've found an item of clothing in the bush reserve behind the Delaney's house that you'll want to see. I'm sending you a picture now. She opened her email and clicked on the photo attached. It was a T-shirt screen printed with a distinctive design of three flowers, orange, red and yellow. Gerberas. Is that... Yes, said Pete. It's covered in blood. Chapter 52. Thank you for coming in today, Mr. Delaney, said Christina. Ethan noted that her manner was businesslike, not at all aggressive. She seemed to be speaking with the friendly, detached authority of a medical specialist who has asked a patient to come back in for a serious follow-up appointment. You know Constable Lim, of course? She indicated Ethan. Stan looked over at Ethan and nodded, folding his arms across his barrel chest. Yep. Stan Delaney's wife had been missing now for 19 days. The scratches on his face were completely healed. Ethan noted that he'd shaved for this